Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. When I returned to studying education after my initial teaching qualification, one question that preoccupied me was whether it's more important for a teacher to know their subject well or to know how to teach well. We've all heard about the person who's a genius at maths or science but who falls down when communicating it to others. Yet, would we really want to learn swimming or French or the piano from someone who only knew how to teach but was shaky on their knowledge of those subjects? The research that helped me resolve this question, to some extent at least, was developed by my guest on the programme this week, Professor Lee Shulman. He came up with the idea that there's a special kind of knowledge held uniquely by teachers which combines knowledge of the subject and knowledge of how to teach it. He called this knowledge pedagogical content knowledge, and the term has become widely used by educators who are interested in the education of teachers. On last week's programme, Professor Shulman also told us about signature pedagogies. These are the types of teaching that educate future practitioners for their professions. However, teacher education, he claimed, did not really have a signature pedagogy. On last week's programme, Lee Shulman also predicted that teacher educators are going to get better at using simulations in educating teachers in the future. So to begin this week's conversation, I asked Lee Shulman if simulations had the potential to become a signature pedagogy for teacher education.
A signature pedagogy will never have a single instructional method. It will always, in any profession, because professions are so complicated, it will always be a suite, a kind of symphony of methods. The key, I think, to learning professional practice, which is almost always learning to do routinely that which can be done routinely, and then when confronted with uncertainty and unpredictability and novelty, learning how to manage that uncertainty, how to make judgments under uncertainty, and how to take actions under predictability. Learning to take actions under predictability require a great deal of practice. If you want to be a fine violinist, but you practice the same scales over and over and over again. You want to be a surgeon? You spend hundreds of hours learning to sew and tie knots like a sailor. And nobody says, oh, that's Mickey Mouse stuff. Those teachers are only sewing. With surgeons, they never say that, because the routine is understood within a larger suite and symphony of practices. Simulations are important because, let's think about the simulations used to train a plane pilot. You don't have somebody learning to fly, get on the plane and sit with the pilot during the takeoff, then by and large sit with them and watch them during the 6 hours of, in the United States, transcontinental flight, because the highest level of expertise is needed in takeoff and landing. In simulation, you take those critically important areas, you use various forms of documentation and recording to capture what expert practitioners do in those settings, then you program in the kind of what Jerome Bruner has called the vicissitudes of intention that characterize unpredictable situations that work, and they practice responding to variations. And you can do that with simulation. If what you're trying to train a teacher to do is respond to the unpredictable, and the way you do that is to put them in an ordinary classroom for a year, what if the unpredictable of the sort you want them to learn to do doesn't happen? It only happens the first day they're actually independently out in practice. So in that sense, simulation can be very, very powerful. It's not the only thing, but it's sure a missing link.
If we move on to another topic, Lee, 3 decades ago this year, you introduced the world to the idea of pedagogical content knowledge. 30 years on now, how do you understand this term?
Well, there are some ways in which I understand it exactly as I understood it 30 years ago, which shocks me. First of all, the first big idea that I thought was insufficiently appreciated and dealt with in American teacher education. Again, I can't speak of Ireland, I can't speak of Belgium, was my strong belief that the bedrock of teaching well was having a deep, deep appreciation, understanding, and if at all possible, sordid love affair with the subject matter that you're teaching. If I want someone to teach English, literature, and grammar, if I have a choice, I want someone who is passionate about that area, not only because they once saw a movie about a teacher of literature, because they love to read, they have read widely, they understand reading as an act of not passive absorption, but of interpretation and of mental effort. And I mean, it's something that, in the same way, and you were a student of Deborah Ball, a good mathematic teacher thinks of mathematics as the code that makes the universe run and the beauty of a quadratic equation.
Yeah.
And some of those listening to this broadcast will say, what in the world is he talking about? And until you get some sense of that, and I'm not a mathematician, but oh, I can see some of that beauty. So the teaching of mathematics, for example, in my country, at the primary grades, is a serious problem. And I would assert that one of the reasons it's a serious problem is because many of the people who go into primary school teaching go into it as a way of escaping from having to study mathematics. And it should instead be, we want you to internalize this sense of the wonder of mathematics. Not all of mathematics, not calculus and number theory, but one of my students was a woman, a Chinese woman named Li Ping Ma. I think you know Li Ping's work.
Indeed.
And she pointed out, as your mentors, Hai Bass and Deborah Ball, have, that the wonder of mathematics shows up at third and fourth grade. What's the difference between an odd and an even number? So a deep understanding of the subject. That said, we also know plenty of people who are scholars of Shakespeare, who are experts in mathematics, who are extraordinary writers, who couldn't teach somebody else mathematics or writing or Shakespeare to save their life. There is a difference between knowing something and knowing it in a manner that prepares you to teach it. And as somebody you've already interviewed on this program demonstrated in her own first book and doctoral dissertation, I'm talking about Pam Grossman, she compared two groups of people who were equally well prepared in the area of Shakespeare, but only half of them had been prepared in the pedagogy of Shakespeare. And when they took on the challenge of teaching Hamlet to their respective classes, the design and the teaching of the two Hamlet courses were dramatically different. She titled that analysis A Tale of Two Hamlets, and I thought it was a wonderful pun. But the pedagogy of Shakespeare is not the same as the pedagogy of the quadratic formula, nor of the pedagogy of clinical medicine, nor of the pedagogy of beginning piano or beginning reading. And that's where you get pedagogical content interaction. And so as I began doing, first of all, these thought experiments, and then we began to actually study people learning to teach in these different areas, we began getting observational, empirical support of the notion that the pedagogies were very different. In fact, I still remember Pam Grossman as a graduate student. Hard to think of for the new dean of the School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. She did a study of an English teacher in secondary school. And during the first week that she observed her, she was teaching some form of English literature. And Pam characterized her as creative, inventive, and encouraging classroom participation, interaction, and discussion. This was a vibrant, interactive, discussion-based classroom. She thought she had the teacher pegged. The next week, she came back to watch the teacher again, expecting to see the same kind of pedagogy. But the teacher was teaching English grammar and syntax. This teacher looked as if she had been cloned from an utterly different species. Highly didactic. She didn't leave enough space for a student to ask a question. As we say in one of the histories of the American War of 1812, I think it was, against England, Admiral Farragut said, as torpedoes were being shot at his wooden vessel, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead." Well, this is "damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead" pedagogy. So Pan interviewed her and said, "How is, I thought I knew what kind of, you know, you're like two different people." And her response was, "I really understand literature. I understand it deeply enough that I can take the risk of opening up my classroom and letting the students come up with their own interpretations and hypotheses and pit them against one another. I have the greatest time in the world. And the students love it. Not only do I not like grammar, the fact is I don't think I understand it. It all seems so ad hoc and almost impossibly unmotivated in some way. You know, why is it who here and whom there? And
random.
Why is it? Yeah, it just seems random. It seems unjustified. And so I have to teach it. It's in the curriculum. But I don't want the students asking me questions about why and what if. So damn the syntax, full speed ahead. Even within the same teacher and the same subject matter. And these are examples of pedagogical content knowledge. So I still feel that very, very strongly, that one has to learn the content deeply. Yes, one has to learn general pedagogical techniques of classroom management and organization and what have you. But you also have to, and this is what takes long, have to learn the pedagogies of the contents that you're teaching. What have I learned in the last 30 years? I've learned that I was absolutely right, and pedagogical content knowledge is necessary, but far from sufficient. That notion ignored the emotional, affective aspects of teaching. Empathy, caring, warmth. Now, why didn't I talk about it? Well, I could say I was too stupid to think about it. I could also excuse myself by saying, well, but teacher educators were concerned about empathy and caring and what have you. And in fact, they spent so much time on some of this stuff. It was at the expense of the content and the pedagogy. So there was a kind of rhetorical move. I think I also didn't deal sufficiently with the moral aspects of teaching. You know, 30 years, a long time to get smarter about some stuff. When I talked about what is now called PCK, pedagogical content knowledge, I also should have been talking about pedagogical cultural knowledge, pedagogical context knowledge. In other words, the teaching has to be adapted to more than the content. But when you're teaching in neighborhoods, in communities with very different cultural contexts, are you teaching the children of Pakistani immigrants, of Orthodox Jews, of wealthy Anglo-Saxon? Who are you teaching? What kinds of analogies work? What kind of relationship between students and between student teacher will help things along? And so I guess the more I think about PCK, the more full and rich a complex a notion it is. And if you say, but how can you do all of this in 11 months? My answer is, by the same token, that you can't have a baby in 4 months because you don't have much time for 9. And by the same token that we're prepared to spend 11 years to prepare a physician, let's strike a compromise. Let's also recognize, and that's why in the last 7 years of medical education, they're almost in full-time practice and then being mentored. Most of teacher education over time will be induction, mentoring, supervision, will be learning on the job. And when people ask me, what's your definition of an effective school? It's a very simple definition. An effective school is a school that is at least as educative for its teachers as it is for its students. It's designed for both to be learning, because that's what it'll take. I mean, are you a sports fan at all?
Sure.
Okay.
Probably not American sports, though.
No, but I'll bet there's one category of professional and non-professional sports that's common across countries. If you look at American football or baseball or what we call soccer, in the professional leagues, the players don't show up on Monday and have their first regular game on Tuesday. They spend a month, 6 weeks, sometimes 2 months, in practice, learning to the plays, practicing, and often practicing the fundamentals before they then have some exhibition games that don't count, and then the real league games. And we don't marvel at that. And yet we expect our teachers to build a career without what we call spring training. That is insane. We have to show as much respect for teaching as we do for kicking.
Do you think, though, that the term pedagogical content knowledge has been a victim of its own success in the sense that it has been used right around the world, but people don't always mean the same thing by it, and that sometimes it can actually muddy the water a bit because people have almost taken on their own meaning of it? Like, I remember telling somebody about it and they said, oh, you're talking about the methods. And no, that wasn't what I was talking about, but that's how they had understood it.
The last time I looked, that article that I was based on the speech I gave 30 years ago has been cited in professional literature 12,000 times. And of course, that doesn't count the, who knows, tens of thousands of times people have simply uttered it, as you just did. I mean, I don't think your exchange with whoever it was got counted as a citation. And I used to get very disturbed by this concern that people were misusing the idea. There are two reasons why I'm less and less disturbed now. One is that very often, when they use it in ways that I would not have used it, they've actually elaborated it in smarter ways than I could have myself. One of the nice things about publishing your ideas and making them accessible to anyone, nobody has to pay me royalties to use the idea of pedagogical content knowledge, is that just as people can trivialize and bastardize the idea, oh, you're just talking about methods, of course, not what I mean. Although, to what extent, if the methods are the kind of high-leverage practices that Deborah Ball talks about, or Pam Grossman talk about, where they're talking about practices that involve the combination of pedagogy and they're absolutely right. So, for example, I'll use Ball as an example again, because like you, I adore her and respect her. Unlike you, I knew as a student before I knew her as a teacher. Deborah, in order to distinguish some of the stuff that she does from the stuff I do, or did, she talks about content-specific pedagogy, not pedagogy. And it's a nuance, it's a shift, or mathematical content for teaching, where she's reframing the notion of content. You know, I see these as improvements. So just because somebody is using it differently doesn't mean they're doing a disservice. They may be doing the most wonderful thing. It's a little bit, you know what it's like, Sean? It's like sending your kid away to school. You're sending that child away to be improved in ways that you couldn't do yourself, to good teachers who know how to do things you don't know how to do. So that's one reason. Another reason is, I guess, what I call Shulman's Law. I think I call different things Shulman's Law over time. But there is a principle in linguistics called Zipf's Law. I've actually written about it, which says that the more frequently a word or a word type is used in any language, the higher the probability that it will be either conjugated or declined irregularly. So if you think about a word like go, it isn't I go and yesterday I goed, it's I go and yesterday I went. I am, I was. I mean, it doesn't follow the grammatical rules of conjugation. Shulman's Law is that this generalizes to ideas in any discipline or field. The more useful they are, the more frequently they get employed, the higher the probability they become irregular. They get deregulated. It's just the nature. If you've got an idea that turns out to be really useful, expect it to be modified, irregularized, and adapted. And if that's the reason why pedagogical content knowledge is undergoing some of the transformations that should worry me, it's a price I'm prepared to pay. Because what it does, and of course the fellow who said, oh, that's just methods, is an exception to what I'm saying. Pedagogical content knowledge is not a theory. Pedagogical content knowledge is a signal. And what it says is the world of teaching and learning is filled with intersections where content and teaching meet. And if you're driving along those roads, what you have to be smart about at the intersection is rather different than what you need to be smart about if you're just driving along one of those roads alone. The classroom, even if the classroom is a MOOC or something like that, is made up of a multiplicity of such intersections. That's where the action really happens. And the intersections' characteristics are not the same, no matter which two streets are meeting. In fact, some of them are roundabouts that have a certain characteristic. Some are roundabouts where eight streets are meeting. Some of them have bumpies. You know, I mean, it just, you can play with that. As you know, I'm very interested in representations. But if you get that mental image, then what PCK does is call your attention to wherever I am, what's the intersection I'm at? Because if it's an important area, it's not the case that it's a one-way street and I can damn the torpedoes full speed ahead. I've got to ask myself, what kinds of representations, interactions, empathies, and what have you, need to be discovered, engaged, invented to exploit the potential of this intersection?
I want to now move on, Lee, and ask you about some more personal, professional questions, if you like. And the first one is, how did you first get interested in education from a professional perspective?
I got interested in education at a Jewish summer camp where the director of programs in the camp was a man, his name was Seymour Fox, who was a University of Chicago student and was much inspired by the great books curriculum at the University of Chicago, especially by a man named Joseph Schwab, who was one of his teachers. Schwab became a role model and a mentor for him. And he wasn't the only one. I mean, there were others as well. There was the psychoanalyst Bruno Bettelheim. There were a whole set of intellectuals whose voices permeated this camp. It was a two-month educational institution, this camp, in ways that made the camp a very extraordinary place. But in serious ways, it made educational thinking, philosophical thinking, the psychology, this was the influence of the Bettelheim influence, of how settings educate and not just teachers, but an entire 360, 24/7 environment, that a number of us who came to that camp, and it was supposed to be a Jewish kind of religious camp, and some people did end up going into religious, but many of us became social scientists, and in fact went to the University of Chicago to try to find our way to some of these same people. So I'd say that was the beginning. And it wasn't, I'd say, social science. David Riesman was a very important character in his notion of interdirected and other-directed people and societies. And there's a whole bunch of ideas. When I got to the University of Chicago, I started studying with people like that. And Schwab became my mentor as well, though not the only significant teacher. And he began asking us, even though we were only in our late teens, questions like, we call this a subject matter or a discipline. What makes it a discipline? Is it like a rabbit? You look at it, you can tell it's a species or something? The University of Chicago was a place that problematized knowing and knowledge. I ended up getting my undergraduate degrees in liberal general studies. I never had a real major. You could do that at Chicago. You could be a generalist. But I kind of focused on philosophy, but especially on epistemology. I was so taken with this question of, what does it mean to know something? And I ended up doing a bachelor's thesis that was actually much harder to do than my PhD thesis on theories of perception in Freud, Hume, Kant, and Hegel. Yeah, you've just made a face, and you were absolutely right. Talk about the arrogance of a 20-year-old at the University of Chicago. And yet, even though I was utterly inept, I learned so much about fundamentally different ways of thinking about how is it possible for somebody who doesn't know something to know something, to recognize what a miracle that is. And as you start thinking about it from a learning perspective, before you know it, you're thinking about it from a teaching perspective. What can somebody do to help someone move from a state of, you know, if I were doing medicine, it would be, how can you take someone and help them move from a state of illness into a state of health? If I were to be a lawyer, and I thought about that for a while, I mean, how do you help someone move from the presumption of guilt to the presumption of innocence? I mean, there are transformations of various kinds are what so many activities are about. How can you have, Jerome Bruner taught me this one many, many years later, but he was quoting a British philosopher named Weldon, and he said, Weldon said about philosophy and about learning about the world, he said, the world has three kinds of events to think about here, and these are what I now call messes, puzzles, and problems. Messes are what we confront in everyday life. Oh my God, this is a mess. What am I going to do now? Okay. Puzzles have neat parameters. You may not know what to do, but you know what the rules of the game are, and you can tell when you're done. So imagine a jigsaw puzzle. 1,000 pieces all over the place, but it's not a mess because you know, you look at the cover of the box, you know what it's going to look like when you get it all done. And you've got some rules of, well, if it's flat sides, it's probably, you know, you've done jigsaw puzzles. Yeah. But also playing blackjack is a jigsaw puzzle. I mean, it's a puzzle. He said, you've got a problem. When confronted with a mess, you can figure out some sort of puzzle to lay on it. When you can so frame a mess, you know, and that's why Dewey said a problem well framed is half solved, then you can begin working on a problem. And that was the sort of thing I was learning at Chicago. And even though I approached it philosophically initially, at the doctoral level, I made it into a psychological problem as I was prepared in educational psychology, studied that sort of thing. And even in my doctoral dissertation, which was done in a school of education, I recognized that teachers were a good example of a population that was dealing with problems and that kind of problem all the time. Let's face it, you walk into a school or a classroom, you got a mess in front of you. Then you've all got a puzzle called the curriculum. But how do you somehow do that? And during that period, I supported myself by teaching. I would teach 20 hours a week. I was a camp director, so I dealt in informal education. I mean, I worked in a variety of pedagogical and youth development activities, though I never, during that period of my life, got formal teacher education. My formal education was to become an educational psychologist, and my practices were teaching and youth work. And then I began a career educating teachers and learning from them.
And we've all learned so much from Lee Shulman. I want to thank my guest on the program this week, Professor Lee Shulman, Professor Emeritus at Stanford University. Remember, you can get in touch with the program by emailing feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.